You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
What a great podcast with Annie Duke, professional poker player, but also the author of a great, great brand new book, How to Decide, and she gives simple tools for making better choices. She's been on the podcast before, about 2 years ago, where we talked about her other book, Thinking in Probabilities. But this book, How to Decide, it's so good. Like, let's say you're trying to decide between five different businesses you want to start, or five different jobs you want to take, or five different colleges you want to go to, or things you want to study, people you want to date. This is such a great book for figuring out how to reduce the risk in decision-making, how to overcome the possible cognitive biases. It's basically the meta skill of how to decide in any domain you want to get better at. What I loved about this podcast was we started talking this conversation, and then Jay hit the record button, and we're just talking all over the place about a billion different things, all valuable, all things that I learned from. So many interesting stories and a lot of knowledge learned, plus some really concrete tools for making decisions. So here we go, Annie Duke.
So there's signposting and there's sort of deadline setting. So it a little bit depends on how much you're deciding behind the veil of ignorance. So let's say that you kind of know everything there is to know about the environment. So you're flipping coins. You can basically just decide after a certain number of flips, I'm going to know what I need to know and I'll stop.
Yeah.
Right? Because you know what the volatility of the environment is already. So you can basically say, if I flip a coin X number of times, then I'll know what the heads or tails ratio is. I'll know how the coin is weighted. And then I'll be able to tell what I'm supposed to do. So there's, if you have a lot of information about something, you can just set a quitting deadline. After this point, I will quit.
Right.
But right?
That involves an environment where you very much understand the probabilities of the possible outcomes.
Exactly. So then if you can't do that, you would do signposting, which is to say, if I get certain information back, then I will exit. Basically, it's setting up an exit plan. Let's make it simple. You're buying a stock. You've made explicit what your implicit assumptions are, what the inputs are into buying that have to do with, you know, something like how many widgets are they going to make or what is the macro environment going to look like. And then you can signpost it, which is essentially if these things change in the environment or if an assumption that I have turns out not to be true, and this is how I would know that, then it doesn't matter whether I'm winning or losing in the investment, I'll exit.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So, I've been a day trader and a hedge fund manager. So I call that a story stop, where if the story changes, then I stop out. A lot of people use, you know, loss stops, where if I lose X percentage of money, then I stop out. But you know, just I've written software and I don't know of anyone else who's done this. Statistically, price stops never work. There's not a single trading system where price stops actually make you more money with less volatility or even have less volatility. Price stops always have more volatility, oddly, because you lose a lot more and your P&L goes down a lot more easily.
Yeah, of course, because the issue is that you should be treating, theoretically, if you're omniscient and you had unlimited computing power, then every second that you held a stock, you would be thinking about it as a new buy order.
Even without omniscience and compute, that's how you should think about it.
Right, except that we can't, you can't stop and evaluate your portfolio every minute, right? And say, would I buy this this second? Would I buy this this second? Would I buy this this second? That's what I'm saying. So you need to have some, you know, you could do it at the end of the day, for example. You could do it.
All right.
That's all I'm saying. So you would want to approach it. The problem is that people don't approach those the same way. They think about it as, should I sell this? They don't think about it as, would I buy this right now, today?
Right. And you're right. The very important question is, would I buy this right now? given everything. And or like,
and that's what a story, that's what you're saying. That's what a story stop or signposting does for you, is it tells you what the conditions would have to are, would be, why did you invest in the first place? And what are the things that would change in the world that would make it that you would not do this investment as a new investment? And you do that work kind of in advance so that you sort of lose the sunk cost issue and the endowment issue. That's why the story stop is really good, because it reframes it as a new buy order. Yeah. That kind of automatically reframes it that way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's interesting because like one time, this is just a quick story. One time I started a business. It was going to be a dating site based on Twitter. So my algorithm that I wrote kind of analyzed people's tweets and sort of tried to determine compatibility. And I raised $1 million in the first round, built the site, got signups. And then the morning after the day that all the money came in, I woke up shaking. Like I had this enormous feeling this business wasn't going to work out. And a year later, I would be on the phone with everybody explaining why they lost their money and blah, blah, blah. And so I just wired everyone's money back and instantly shut down the business. And of course, who knows in retrospect whether I made the right decision or not. But sometimes too, it's just part of it's experience, part of it's some kind of gut or intuition. Part of it might be some bias that I was experiencing or some fear. But sometimes you just have to quit. Even, you know, like the story stop is when things are going negative. Sometimes you also have, there has to be signposting somehow when things are going positive. You're in an infinite game with imperfect information, and you just have to have ways of navigating that as well on the upside.
That's why the signposting actually works. If these signposts were to occur, regardless of whether I'm winning or losing, then I will stop.
Yeah.
And you can figure out whatever those signposts are, right? So it's trying to kind of disconnect you from this kind of path dependence of our decision-making gets really distorted depending on the path that we're taking. So I don't want to say winning or losing kind of in absence of the path, because we interpret that differently depending on what our recent path is. Do we have an upward slope or a downward slope that we've just been experiencing, right? And essentially what happens, and you can see this like across retail investors, is a very robust finding. Retail investors will put in stop loss orders and they'll just blow by them. But then they'll also put in takedown orders. Like as soon as you've earned a certain amount on a stock, that's the moment that you're going to buy. So they have those orders as well. And they sell too early. So you have both problems happening. So those in combination, obviously, are a really bad combo. The reason that they're doing it, obviously, that brokers or financial advisors will encourage that is because retail investors are particularly susceptible to the issues of how do you make decisions when you're losing versus when you're winning. And so they're trying to sort of give them some kind of pre-commitment contracts in order to hold their feet to the fire. The problem is that they blow through them. Basically, they sell too early on the winners and they sell too late on the losers. What signposting can help you do is kind of disconnect from that. It's just like, if these things are true of the world, this is what you're going to do.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Warren Buffett has a famous quote about not selling your winners, which is if you have Michael Jordan on your team, you don't trade him away just because right. He's gotten better. But, you know, also in a lot of what you're saying, you have to take into account the agendas of the other parties involved. Like brokers they want you to sell and buy new things because they churn and they make commissions.
Well, that's why I switched it to the financial advisor, which is a little different. So,
So
obviously you need to make sure incentives are aligned.
Finance is a great domain because there is kind of probabilities and there is kind of sort of 1-0 decisions. But it's also interesting on domains where there are other factors like boredom or lifestyle or, and you know, you address lifestyle in this book, but I often find the world's very complicated on quitting because no one really has good experience with quitting. And it's often not statistical.
So I actually think it's interesting because I think that we all have a lot of experience with quitting. It's just that we view it through such a negative frame. Show me the aphorism, which is like, quitting's really good. They're all things like, well, you have the American can-do spirit. You have winners never quit and quitters never win. If at first you don't succeed, try again. You know, it's like everything is around this really negative connotation around quitting. And so when it comes to kind of like big things, I think that we don't do it very much. And it's too bad because obviously grit and sticking to things is really, really important. It's a great virtue to have grit and to be able to power your way through the hard stuff in order to get to the good stuff. There's no question. You can't be successful without that. The problem is, how do you decide what to be gritty about? And then how do you actually execute on the things that you're being gritty about in a really A-plus, like, world-class way? And the way that you do that is through quitting. And the problem is that we don't think about quitting through that frame of experimentation. This is one of the best ways to gather information from the world that's really necessary, instead of fooling yourself that you can analyze the situation and actually find out your answer. So an example is, obviously, I know you're a comedian. Until you actually get up in front of the audience and you try the joke out, it's just really hard to know if it's going to land. You can do the thought experiment. You can kind of think through it. You can sort of know how you're supposed to construct a joke. But until you try it, you can't really find out the information. So you need to just get quickly to the trying. And then if it doesn't work, you have to quit. You have to say, I'm not doing that joke anymore. I'm going to do another one, or I'm going to prune it, or I'm going to change it a little
bit. Right. You have to experiment. There's no way to know one time, but you have to adjust the experiment.
Right. And it's like, what do we think of as quitting? It's not just like, I quit my job, which sometimes is really good, by the way. I mean, I play tennis. It's like, I tried a shot and it didn't work out, and so I'm not going to do that again. Or it didn't work out, but I am going to try that again. I didn't execute on it well, but it was actually a really good idea. It would have worked. I mean, it's all this experimentation is really a form of quitting. Science is a form of quitting.
It's so funny, because the first chapter of my book, Skip the Line, is I essentially replace the 10,000 hour rule with what I call the 10,000 experiment rule, because experiments really are the key to learning, not repetition, unless it's just you're trying to memorize lists of numbers or something, some simple domain. You know, and again, the real world is so much more complicated that a lot of experimentation is required to actually learn things that are useful in society.
That's exactly right. And you can't be really experimental in your choices if you're not willing to quit. And aside from, because otherwise you'll just stick to stuff that you shouldn't. But the other problem is that you can't experiment enough if you're not willing to quit. Because if you enter into a decision thinking, I need to be 90% sure this is going to work, which is how a lot of us are, right? You have to be 90% sure it's going to work, because this is like a final decision. Like, this is final sale. I'm not going to return it. I can't return it. Then you're going to get into these like analysis loops that aren't even going to get you the information that you want, when you should actually just be kind of like moving fast and breaking things, as they say in the Valley. You're trying to figure out the answer prior to the doing. So unless you say, there's just a whole bunch of stuff I'm going to try, I'm going to quit all the stuff that doesn't work, figure out what it tells me about what I would want to try next, and I'm going to do a ton of that, then you can't move fast enough to actually live an experimental life that's actually going to get you the answers that you need in order to build really good models of the world, so that when you do actually enter into something that is high impact and incredibly hard to reverse, it's going to be a big cost in order to change it, that you're actually going to make really good decisions about those things. The simple thing is like dating versus marrying. Like, you shouldn't spend a year trying to figure out who to go on a date with. You should just go on a date with somebody. And you should go on a date with a lot of people. And you should have lots of dinners, and you should talk to a whole bunch of different people. And because you can, you know, a date, you can quit it in the middle. You can say, I'm sorry, I'm not staying for dessert. This isn't going well. It's just go. But the marriage thing, that's what you're really trying to solve for, is that at some point you're going to have to make a decision about who to marry. And there's a huge cost on winding that decision. It costs a lot to do it.
So you better have
a really good model of yourself and what your preferences are. You have to have a really good model of other people, really good model of what you want for yourself in the future. And all of those things are going to come through the doing, the moving fast, for all the stuff that's going to like gather the information for you, that's going to allow you to build a good model when you actually have to get to that big decision.
I mean, all of these are different angles on just the central concept of learning.
Yep.
Whether it's how to decide, or thinking in probabilities, or quitting, or experimenting, or the 10,000 hour rule. This is just all different ways to kind of build this model of the world. And it's interesting because, you know, even in neuroscience, the brain is not really that good at making decisions. It's actions precede decisions often, where you're already acting in terms of that you've made the decision, and then your brain says, okay, I'm going to make this decision. And so it's interesting to tie that in as well, particularly with the quitting, I think.
Well, I think that that's why you have to have this intentional, people have to develop this mental model. And I think that people don't, you know, I think this is the big downside of something like 10,000 hours, right? Is that it puts that doing something for a long time, you know, in this kind of placeholder of such a virtue. And you forget that the opposite of that virtue is also a virtue, because the way, you know, we think in dichotomies, we think in opposition, right? So the idea that you might do something for a second and then immediately abandon it, you know, well, then I won't be successful. Then you're going to call me a failure, you know, so on and so forth. And so I think that we need to develop this mental model. We have to wrap it into our decision-making so that when we are thinking through problems, the way that we're approaching the problem just becomes different. So the avenues that open up in terms of the types of decisions that might be available to us, the types of actions that might automatically, whether it's in that more intuitively, how am I thinking about this decision, right? Which is what we want to change, because it's just like habits. We can get those things running more automatically, right? Because you can examine your decision-making in a really intentional way in the same way that you examine habits in a really intentional way. And you can say, I want to change that habit and I want to let that habit continue to run kind of under the surface, you know, and then you have to practice with the new habit in order to get that to be something that then becomes automatic after you get enough iterations on it. And I think you can do the same thing with your decisions and what kind of mental models are you viewing problems through, because we're doing that anyway, right? Yeah. I mean, we're all doing that anyway. So you can be intentional about your mental models just in the same way that you can be intentional about your habits.
It's so important, because I'm assuming you and I both know many people who spend 20 years doing something, but they never seem to get better. 20 years playing chess, 20 years investing, 20 years, you know, starting businesses, 20 years doing comedy. A lot of people, but why don't they get better? I think it's because they don't have this model of constant experimentation. So for instance, I did comedy last night. If I go out and perform, I always make sure my model for this is at least 20% of my set has to be an experiment. So this way I know through hell or high water, I'm going to always be at least increasing my comfort zone. I might not be getting better, but I'm at least increasing my comfort zone. And so at some point you have to get better if you keep doing this in an activity that's worthwhile.
Yeah. I think one of the ways to think about it, I had a really great conversation with Michael Mobison, who's, you know, obviously super fabulous and everybody should read everything he's ever written. He was talking about this framework to think about the difference between explore and exploit. You can imagine this in terms of kind of, you know, as you try to figure out what happens to an IBM in the 1980s when Microsoft or Apple come in, right? So explore versus exploit is essentially what you just talked about. Exploit is, these are things that I know work for me, and so I'm going to exploit those things. I'm going to exploit those strategies. I'm going to sort of stick to those things. You can think about it as like, I like this restaurant. And I know the food's always consistent and it's always good. So that's the place I'm going to go. Explore is, well, what are the new things I could try? What are the different ways that I could look at the world? What are the innovative things that I could be doing? Is there something that I'm missing? You know, that kind of stuff. So that would be like going to a new restaurant. Or in your case, 80% of your set is stuff that you've tried before that you know people are going to laugh at. You're exploiting that. Not exploiting in a bad word way, but in more of a game theoretical way, right? Like you're doing something that you know you can take to the bank. And then 20% of it is explorative. Let me sort of poke around and kind of see what's going on. So you want to try to get that right balance, right? So you can think about like an IBM versus a Microsoft or an Apple in the 1980s. What happens when companies get kind of big and bloated is that they end up completely in the exploit mode. We have certain customers, we have a certain product, we have certain strategies, we know that they've worked in the past and we're just going to continue to exploit those things. And of course, startups by definition are all explore.
Yeah.
That's just definitionally true. So they're going to find the new stuff that's better. You know, the way to take a business that was traditionally being delivered in a certain way and turn it into a SaaS play or, you know, whatever, right? And we're going to do something better because they're in that explore and they don't have an investment in the infrastructure that exploits a certain avenue. The people that are working for them are very averse to any kind of failure. So they don't want to experiment because there's this really interesting interaction that you can think about. So let's say that you're exploiting a strategy. In other words, you're doing things the way that things have always been done. Particularly, you're getting consensus on that. And you're working in a company. and you have a bad outcome from that, people will be like, oh, that's bad luck. But if you are in explore mode and you fail, then you're an idiot. Then your job's on the line. Then you get fired.
Right. And believe me, whether it's poker or investing, but particularly comedy, you're in front of a room full of strangers, plus some people who know you, like the people who brought you in to do the set, for instance, that you need their respect. You feel humiliated or ashamed in real time, even if you're planning to do this exploit strategy. But what you're saying about IBM reminds me of Clayton Christensen's theories of disruption. It's almost like explore is you have to consciously do self-disruption before other companies do it. Like,
that's right.
You know, Microsoft and Apple both successfully disrupted IBM's business model by coming in either cheaper or more nimble or whatever, you know, these classic disruption theories. So it's interesting, you know, like with poker, for instance, you could say, all right, a beginning player play just, you know, high pairs or combinations of two, you know, face cards and don't do anything else. But then you still have to explore, like, as you get better and better, as you know, of course, you know, you're going to bluff, you're going to try bluffing in these certain situations. You have to start doing the explore.
I have a great story about that. It's totally true. You're dead on. So when I very first started playing, this predates my becoming a professional player. I was a poor graduate student living on a stipend, $13,000 a year. That's what I was living on. And so I couldn't afford, like, there were no like vacations in my budget. So my brother was already a successful player. So he flew me out to Las Vegas during the World Series of Poker to like have a vacation, you know, because I was like a poor starving student. So I went out, and prior to that, I had watched him play a little bit, but I was sitting right behind him where I could see his hole cards. But when you're playing in the World Series of Poker, there's like a rope set up, like a rail. And so you can't actually get close. And, you know, unlike watching poker on TV, watching poker in person is actually super boring because you can't see anybody's cards. So it's one of the more boring activities. Like when I was sitting behind my brother, I could kind of be in his position, and that made it quite interesting to kind of try to figure out what his choices were. But now it was really boring for me. And I also don't like negative EV propositions. So I wasn't like, you know, playing craps or something like that, right? Because I've no interest in just like grinding out a loss. So I was bored. So we went to the coffee shop in Binion's Horseshoe, which was like down in the basement. At the time, this was still owned by the Binions. And they also had a ranch up in Montana where they got their meat from. And at the time, I was not a vegan, which I am now. I ate meat then. And they had a $1.99 steak special. So if you went in after midnight, you could get like a big, it was like a 12-ounce, like Kansas City cut steak with like a potato, a roll, salad, vegetable. Like it was a great deal for someone like me. So my brother and I were there after midnight eating, and I'm complaining to him that I'm like super bored. So he says to me, well, you know, you obviously know the rules of the game. You sat behind me and watched me play. Like, why don't you just go play poker? And he handed me $300, and then he took out a napkin and a Kino crayon. And he said, Annie, here are the hands you're allowed to play. And he wrote them down on this napkin. It was like aces, kings, queens through, I think he was letting me play sixes.
That's a bit daring, but yeah, but go ahead.
It was limit though. It was limit poker. It wasn't no limit. So no limit, I would not allow a beginner to play sixes, but it was limit. So, there was only so much that I could impale myself on other people's chips. And then I think he had ace, king, ace, queen, ace, jack. I think king, queen, king, jack. I think that was kind of like the list, as I recall. So that was a pretty narrow set of hands. And I went off to the Fremont, which was like across the street from Binion's. Like the marquee restaurant in the Fremont was a Carl's Jr. It was like really something. And I went and played in this, I think it was like $1 to $3 game. And so I just had my list, right? And so I was literally only entering pots with this list. So obviously there were people in that game who were playing hands that were very far off the list. They were totally not on the list at all. But, you know, I just sort of kept playing with my list. And I did pretty well with the list, you know, because I was an experienced player. And I think I won $300, which was amazing, right? Like that was a lot of money to me back then. But then I still had this list, and I played for like another year. And I kept seeing people play hands that were off the list. And there were particular circumstances in, under which they were very likely to play off list hands, like when they were closer to the button, when they were in the blinds, they were different calling with hands that were definitely off the list. And kind of in this explore exploit, like I was just so endowed to this list. Like I was so sure, like my brother had given me a list, like it was like Moses coming down from the mount with like the 10 commandments, that clearly if people were playing hands that were not on this list, they must've been wrong. Now I wasn't playing every day, right? Cause I'm still only playing occasionally. This was like right before I became, before I started playing for real, but it didn't occur to me. It was like a year that I was playing where all these people were doing things off list. And in my head, I was just thinking, oh, those people are such idiots. Like, why would they play off list? And I think finally what happened was somebody who I really believed to be a good player, I saw them like playing these hands that were way off the list. And in particular, you know, kind of starting to notice, I started getting enough experience that I noticed that there were circumstances under which they were doing that. And it finally occurred to me to ask the person who made the list, hey, so I'm seeing people play, like they'll be in the blind and someone will raise and they'll call like a 6-7, which is like not on your list. And I don't understand what's going on. And of course he said, well, Annie, what's going on is they're getting 3.5 to 1. Like, of course they're playing the 6-7. And then he pauses and goes, oh yeah. So let me explain. I gave you that list because you were a beginner. And so I didn't want you doing anything nutty. I just wanted to make sure that you were playing the best hand because there was no way for you to understand how you might play a hand that was worse or like what the value of a hand was. Please throw that list out. Like, don't use the list anymore. Like, you obviously know enough about it, but I, you know, it's like I stuck to that list so long because I didn't understand, like I didn't quite, you know, I didn't get it.
Well, what's so fascinating about that story, and this is related to all of this, you know, all of this aspects of learning, something that's worth learning, is that what happened was is that you expanded the awareness of variables in the domain. So right. At first, the only variable you had was everybody gets 2 cards, which ones should you play? The variable is whether you play a hand or not. But then there's variables like, you know, what your position is at the table, how many people are at the table, what was the betting action beforehand, how many people are, you know, still have to bet. So the variables expand. It's like investing, you know, you start off like, is this a good company or a bad company? But then you realize there's like 1,000 other variables, and that's why you could even write software for investing. Or comedy, you know, is the audience all Democrat? Is the audience all Republican? Are there 5 people in the audience or are there 1,000 people in the audience? Like there's, you know, does the mic work? Is the stage big or is the stage small? Like you start to get, it's some people call them subtleties, but it's really just you become aware of the importance of more and more variables, and that allows you to, you know, build a better multi-factor model that you're making decisions on, whether it's to quit or to play or to whatever. It's interesting, the relationship between variable awareness and learning. I haven't thought about that before.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that I say about poker and most activities is that when you approach them, they can appear quite simple. And then, you know, as you get more deeply into it, as you learn more about it, it's like an onion, you know, and you're peeling away the layers and you think, oh, I've peeled this layer away, that will be the end of it. And then there's another layer and you're like, oh, wait, no, there's more. And then it's like the Ginsu knife. No, wait, there's more. And I think those are actually the most interesting activities to engage in. I think it's why tic-tac-toe is so boring because there's just not a lot of layer to it. It's like, it's just a negative feedback game. I can neutralize any move that you make and we're going to tie every single time. And there's just not much more to it. Like there's not a lot to understand about that game. Whereas, you know, more complicated games are just much more interesting where the game is so complicated that you can't ever actually properly model it.
Right. Well, you know, that's interesting too, because, you know, so what makes a game or an activity interesting? And I had this discussion a long time ago with somebody where, so we just looked at it horizontally, like how many additional variables are. So an expert or master level person would understand, okay, there's 100 variables, and a beginner would just say, no, there's just one variable. But then there's like a vertical way to look at it, which is how many levels of skill are there where if you're at level X, you're one standard deviation above level X minus one. So you could win two out of three games against level X minus one. So for instance, tennis, there might be, or chess or poker, there might be 20 to 30 levels of skill. Right. Whereas tic-tac-toe, there's probably two levels of skill.
Yeah, there's like 7-year-old and everybody else.
Right. And investing also, like investing is like a little different because there's much more imperfect information in the world about investments and entrepreneurship. But it's still, you could argue with investing, it's a defined enough domain that there's 20 or 30 levels of skill. But then, and you talk about this and how to decide, your book, How to Decide, dating and marriage. And you just referenced, you know, dating and marriage. There's probably a lot more levels of skill because it is so insanely imperfect that you say there's no way to model poker, and that's probably correct, but you could at least think about how to model it. Whereas dating would be almost, you know, infinitely complicated to model by a computer. Like, is this the right match for me?
Right. Well, computers are getting okay at modeling poker. I think they would get okay at modeling dating. I'm saying like a human being, it's too complicated for a human being to model it, right? Like without any computational help, right? We just don't have the...
Yeah. But like even poker though, like chess, a computer is significantly better than the best human. There's no poker computer that's better than the best poker players.
Not in a no limit multiplayer game. That's true. They're getting a lot better though.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that obviously like AlphaGo is better than Big Blue, right? It's like the way that those computers are learning is better, but those are pretty constrained environments.
Yeah. Go is a great example where Go was a domain where it was thought to be so infinitely complicated, you would never have a computer solve it. You know, even after chess was quote unquote solved, people never figured that Go would be solved. And yet using the deep learning techniques that Google did, AlphaGo, it was like a surprise out of nowhere, like in the Go world, that AlphaGo comes along and just crushes the world champion.
Yeah.
But it's also a game of perfect information too.
So what I was going to say about that is that I think that we need to distinguish computers are much better at complicated problems, not complex problems. So complicated problems are what you just said, right? Like you have perfect information and a very, very limited, super limited influence of luck. There's some luck in a game like chess. Like from my perspective, if I make a particular move that's exploitable and my opponent doesn't see that they can exploit it, that's luck to me, right? There's some luck in chess, but it's not a strong influence. Like nobody's rolling dice and, you know, seven, yeah, sorry, whatever, you get checkmate. So
theoretically, there's no luck in chess. It's just... There's right. luck on what you might miss because of the skill level, but there's
exactly.
no...
Exactly. And that there's some hidden information. Like, I don't know what opening you were just reading about. I don't know what happened in your last game, you know, but it's minor comparatively. So what that means is that essentially what you can do is you can go from a tic-tac-toe model and then you can complicate the game, which just means building out more complicated decision trees, right? That there's more branches. You have to go deeper into the decision tree in order to be able to, you know, the farther ahead you can see, the better off you're going to be. If you could see all the way to the end of the game, obviously you would be better off. And, you know, you can go tic-tac-toe, then checkers, then chess, then go, right? In terms of how complicated are those trees. But that's really a computational problem. I mean, this was John von Neumann's point in the first place about chess, is that that's a computational power issue. Right? Do you have the computational power to be able to go that deep into the tree? When you get complex is when you start to introduce both an element of luck, but also you force people to decide behind the veil of ignorance. In other words, they just are lacking information. So you can see the transition between a game like chess and a game like poker, it would be backgammon. So backgammon, you have perfect information, but obviously there's an element of luck. It's stochastic, but computers can be very, very good at that because they still have perfect information.
Right. And even AlphaGo, even though you have perfect information, it makes decisions statistically, unlike chess, which, you know, still looks down the tree as far as possible. And, you know, it doesn't use as much statistics. So AlphaGo, in an interesting way, it almost views Go as a game of imperfect information the way it uses statistics. By the way, backgammon and also Othello, similar. There's no luck factor in Othello. There's a luck factor in backgammon. The programs to quote unquote solve them, to be the world champion, were developed much earlier than the programs to solve chess because of these stochastic or statistical processes that similar to how AlphaGo uses it in a much more advanced way.
Right.
I worked on actually what became Deep Blue and was very familiar with at least chess software, Othello software, backgammon software. Hans Berliner solved backgammon like I think early 90s. It's just, it's interesting. But investing also, you can use the same techniques that AlphaGo uses to build quantitative trading programs.
Yes. And you can outperform a human, but you haven't solved the game. I mean,
right.
I think that that's what's key is that something like chess is solvable. Something like poker isn't solvable, at least not in the way that we understand it, right? Because of the hidden information problem. But if you mean I can solve the game out till the end, till the last move, right? That it's just it's essentially just an equation. That doesn't mean that you can't that computers can't get much better than human beings at those things. Of course they can. We know they can. But particularly when you talk about, you know, quantitative trading, you still need a human being to sort of be looking at it. And there's a lot of reasons for that because human beings, you know, what's happening with a lot of these deep learning, and Gary Marcus is someone who everybody should read because he's a real contrarian on kind of deep learning and how great it is. You know, the point that he makes is that human beings really approach information in a different way. So basically what we do is human beings sort of take what we know to be true about the world and we can apply it to something and learn about it in one trial, which computers cannot do yet. And that's a little bit more in my world, like the way that I would view intelligence. So I'll give you a quick example. We know that when you change something that would take it out of the center of the data set that the algorithm might be learning off of, it really trips them up. So for example, if you put a cat in an astronaut suit and you ask a human being, what is that? Never seen it, they'll say it's a cat. I mean, in an astronaut suit. And deep learning will call it an astronaut, right? And you can see this all the time. Like if you can show a baseball glove that has foam on it and they'll call it cappuccino because that's the correlate for cappuccino, right? So this is a thing that algorithms can't do. I'll ask you some questions about this. I'll ask you a few questions. So I want you to imagine for a second, and this is one of Gary Marcus's example. I want you to imagine for a second a blue cat that's bigger than a house.
Okay.
So you have that in your mind,
imagining.
Right?
Yes.
Now you've never seen that before, right?
Never.
Never seen one of those. Okay. So would you be scared of it?
Yeah, I'd be scared of anything that I've never seen before, pretty much.
Right.
90% of the things I've never seen before, I'd be scared of.
Do you think it would be loud? When it meowed, would it be loud?
Okay, if I had to make an assumption, I would say yes.
Yeah. What would happen if it stepped on a car?
I would have to, I don't know for sure, but I would have to imagine it would at least make a dent.
Yeah, probably. Right. Exactly. Okay, so that's good. So let's hold that. Okay. If I say to you, Ellen called her grandmother on the phone, she didn't pick up. Who didn't pick up the phone?
Her grandmother.
Right. So now that's a really interesting one because it's completely ambiguous. So the only reason why you know it was her grandmother who did not pick up is because by having said Ellen called her grandmother on the phone, you understand as a human being that Ellen already has the phone to her ear. She has to. But it's not specifically stated in the sentence that she has picked up the phone. You know things about the real world that in order for someone to call someone, they have to have picked the phone up.
Right.
Right. The other thing that you know is that if I say Ellen called her grandmother on the phone, that she's not standing on top of the phone.
Right.
Right. So you can see there's a lot of ambiguity in that sentence that you literally have not 1 second of problem understand, like parsing apart. Right. So you understand those things much better. Here's another example on the language side. If I said to you, the elephant was on the dog, what image comes to mind?
an elephant killing a dog.
Right.
The dog's flat.
So, and I'll give you another possibility. How about a stuffed elephant?
Oh, well then the dog is just playing with it.
But here's the thing is that when I say the elephant is on the dog, you know, there's something weird, right? You understand that there's something strange
right
about that sentence. And here's the last one that I'll say.
By the way, a computer could tell you there's something strange, but I agree. It can't tell you what's happening.
It can't tell you what's happening, right? So here's my last example. You're looking at a table and there's only one object on the table. And I say to you, can you go pick up the red pencil that's on the table? In that particular case, what you know is that because I did not need to see red, say red, because there's only one pencil sitting on the table, that there must be something particular about the redness of that pencil, right? So it must be like either it's a red pencil or I've done something weird. I've just given you extra information for no reason because you can go pick up the object on the table, right? So this is one of the ways that that would be information theory, that I can communicate to you important things about objects. So when I say a piece of information about something that's totally unnecessary, you as a human being understand that you're supposed to index onto that piece of information more than you otherwise would. So I can walk through all of these different things with you, right? These are all things that computers suck at.
Well, but this is the argument really against the singularity in computers in terms of like this idea that there might be consciousness or human intelligence. AlphaGo might be so far better than humans at the most complicated game on the planet, and yet it can't tell you if an apple tastes good or bad. Like computers are, you know, programmed for purposes and for one reason. So, and the other issue here is that AlphaGo is almost infinitely scalable. So it can just play trillions of games against itself to build up its learning set and get better as a result. But it can't self-generate conversations with itself to learn new meaning. Like that will never happen. So that there's a big difference between deep learning and kind of human learning, which is what you're pointing out. And you know, the people who believe in a singularity sort of believe that computers will bridge the gap, but there's no evidence in the past 80 years that there's no history of computers being able to bridge that gap at all.
Right. And you know, with GPT-3, like, again, I encourage people to go look at, you know, you can follow Gary Marcus on Twitter. You know, he broke it in 2 seconds, right? Like, when you ask it to just kind of generate some speech, it's fine. But as soon as you ask it, like, a question, it really falls apart. And it's for this simple reason, again, that just has to do with what is the knowledge that you're bringing to bear that, like, really means real intelligence. So if I tell you a story that just goes like this, James left the restaurant. I'm just going to tell a story. James left the restaurant and then he patted his front pocket and looked panicked and went back in and asked the wait staff if they had found a wallet. If I ask an algorithm like GPT-3, why did James pat his pocket? The answers they give are total nonsense. Whereas every human being knows that James patted his pocket in panic because his wallet was not there.
Right. But yeah, so this is why, like, I don't believe in deep learning or AI for any kind of, you know, human functions, just for very specific domain specific functions. And even then it depends on the domain, but you know, games are perfect examples where it's a limited domain. Trading, I would consider actually a limited domain, although more complex rather than complicated. So it's maybe perhaps complex, almost going into a human area. But in general, and this is the problem I have with like academic studies on things like anything relating to improvement or learning or even grit. Like I love the book Grit. Angela Duckworth is a genius. I think very highly of her. But any academic studies about mindset or grit, I don't think really accurately reflects the real world, which is why I get nervous about any models for how to succeed at business or entrepreneurship, which are so much more complex than anything a computer can model.
And let me just say, because I'm a huge fan of Angela's, she's the first one to tell you that, you know, she wrote this book about grit and she found it, but she doesn't feel like that's translated into behavior. I mean, this is actually, this is what she's totally focused on now, right? It's like, how do you actually translate that into an improvement in behavior, kind of to your point, right? So she understands that. It's like, that's kind of part of the thing, is that a lot of these things, it's like, well, we kind of know this is important. We know it helps, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people do it. It doesn't mean that we know how to teach people to do it. It doesn't mean that we know how to get people to actually perform better, even though we know this thing matters. And then you always kind of get down to this kind of core issue of, is it kind of an outcome or a correlate of a certain way that people naturally have an ability to think? Or is it something that we really actually know how to teach in order to improve human behavior? So that would be true even in terms of some of the mindset things, right? It's like, it could be that if I just point out to you that, you know, you can improve at stuff, that that's enough for you. But I think it a little bit depends on the way that you kind of view the world. And we know that there are really big differences between people on things like the cognitive reflection test or active open-mindedness that really correlate to things like belief in conspiracy theories, for example, and success and that kind of stuff. And it doesn't necessarily, the problem is that it's still an open question of, can you improve people's performance in a consistent way on something like the cognitive reflection test, or can you improve somebody's ability to become open-minded? My particular viewpoint is that, and I think actually, I just saw Angela talking, and I think that she's definitely thinking in this direction as well, is that it's hard to do for an individual. This is a more of a group problem, in the way, how are groups sort of supporting each other and what are the things that groups value? And if you can kind of harness the power of tribe and make sure that tribe is actually moving you in the right direction, I think that then you can get a lot of movement. But there just hasn't been a lot of sort of study on that, right? Like there's not a lot of work that's done on that. But I think it's starting to happen.
Well, what do you mean? What do you mean by when you focus on tribe?
So I think that, you know, I mean, that old thing of like, we are who we're hanging out with really matters. Like, I'll actually give you an example. Katie Milkman, she has a book coming out in the spring, and there's some really interesting work, and I wish I could remember exactly who the researcher was, but I apologize for not citing, whoever it is, I apologize for not citing you, and hopefully people will find their way to you. But there was a particular researcher who, I think it was, they went to West Point, and they noticed that, I think it was like their brother went also, he might've even been a twin. Can't remember exactly, but they got in West Point, they divide you into different cohorts. And it's random assignment. And what they found was that one of the people who was in one cohort, like really, really performed amazing. And these were people who were sort of equally well in high school and whatnot. And I think they were twins. Like, I think it was sort of a weird natural experiment. But I may be butchering this, and I just want to say that, like, just for the record, I may be butchering it. But anyway, so one person was in one cohort and they had done really well, and the other person was in a different cohort and they really did quite poorly comparatively. And he got really obsessed with looking at that. And what he found was that the cohort that he had been put into, I think, was just like a group of like A+ students just randomly. And they were all like really motivated and they wanted to do really well. And the group that his brother, I think, had been put into was quite poor. So how the group is thinking, right? What are the goals and the values of the group? Because we're so tribal by nature. I think that's the thing that can actually really increase performance. So anyway, so an interesting thing came from that, which is that he thought, well, okay, so now if you could take low performers and you could put them in high performing groups, maybe what you would find is that they would actually do better. That's kind of an interesting question, right? So he did that. He did that, and what he found is they did worse. Okay, really? So that's weird, right? What they figured out, and then Katie Milkman subsequently did some similar research with retirement, was that you can't just take someone who's like a C student and stick them with A students because they feel like they can never get there. You have to get some B students in there as well so that they feel like there's a bridge, that there's a way for them to get to the place that they want to go. That's related to, so Katie Milkman had done something where she was trying to encourage, she was thinking about that research, she was trying to encourage retirement savings. And basically they would tell people who had very low retirement savings, hey, your coworker has already packed away, you know, 10 grand for retirement. And if they were at zero, it actually caused them to save less. But if they said, hey, there's, you know, someone next to you has saved $1,500 for retirement, like something that was a little bit closer, then that got them to actually increase their retirement. So you have to make sure that the group that you put someone in isn't too far away from what your performance is and that you have bridges to it.
See, what's interesting is I do believe statistically that works, right? And so the challenge is, but I also believe that, and just this is just on my own anecdotal experience, is that you do perform better when you're in a group of high-performing people. So why does anecdotal experience sometimes go against what you're saying as, you know, proven in these experiments and statistics and so on? I think then it's a mindset issue of, are you the sort of person who needs the B students in the middle, or are you the sort of student who is learning and understand and has some sort of cognitive bias that you could skip needing that B student in there? For instance, when you were getting good at poker, did you need to, if you had just been thrown in after your beginner phase, if you had just been thrown in with, you know, all great professionals, I bet you still would have done very well. I bet you would have improved very quickly. And I'm assuming even that's what actually happened to you.
So that is what happened to me, but I think that there's a difference between, are you viewing those people as teachers, or are you viewing them as peers?
Right. So that's a mindset thing. And by the way, it could be either way. So, so it just depends on mindset. Like, for instance, I'm extremely guilty of what is called, you know, Dunning-Kruger bias, like always thinking you're better than you are, particularly when you're a beginner. And that's usually considered a bad thing, like a little knowledge, you know, it's whatever the saying is, a little knowledge is a bad thing. But it always helped me because I would have enough confidence to think, oh yeah, well, I could hang out with the best writers or the best investors or the best this, that, even if I wasn't, because I would have this Dunning-Kruger bias, which is this cognitive bias that makes me think I was better than I was. And I kind of would skip the having the B grade students in the middle.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit, so I think it's a little bit whether you view them as mentors or as peers, depending on the activity, depending on whether there's, particularly depending on whether there's money on the line. So as I was learning, if my choice was to play with those world-class players, I would have gone broke right quick.
Right.
Right. But I viewed them as mentors, and then I would go play in my little games, where I did view that I could actually beat them. And I think the same thing is true of investing, right? It's like, if you believe that you're a much better investor than you are, when actually you should just be indexing the market, right? You're probably going to lose money. Now, that being said, finding sort of where your niche is and then making sure that you're learning from the best people and feeling like you can hang out with them and you can learn and you can interact with them, I think that that's all really good. But for anything that really, like, I don't want to think that I'm a world-class skier and because I'm really good on the bunny hill and then just go up to the black diamond, I'll die.
Right. No.
Right. I mean, I think that's the issue. It's like, are you approaching it as, I can hang with anybody in order to learn, and I understand the value of what their input is going to be, but then I also understand where I'm supposed to be performing. Like, I'm going to learn from the black diamond skiers, but I'm still going to stay on the bunny hill until I'm ready. So I think that's a little bit different.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because then I would say, like in the investing example or the poker example, at some point you have to say to yourself, okay, I'm going to learn something, I'm going to hang with the best, but I also have to be very careful about mitigating risk.
Right.
So for instance, with investing, someone like Warren Buffett might be able to put 20% of his portfolio into a single investment, but a crucial rule a good investor should follow in general is money management, put as small as you possibly can into any one. Actually, and I've, again, anecdotally, but the smaller percentage of your net worth you put into an investment, or the small percentage of your hedge fund you put into an investment, ironically, the more money you can make because there's less psychology behind it. So money management becomes critical in poker, critical in investing. And so, yes, you still have to mitigate risk.
That's actually a point that I make just in terms of the new book, in terms of how to decide, is that I say you should approach your decisions the exact same way. It's a portfolio, right? It's just a portfolio problem. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why I'm so into this idea of like keeping quitting in mind, for example, because it allows you to do a whole bunch of things in parallel and create a broader portfolio of decisions so that if any one of those decisions actually doesn't work out very well, right, you're actually positioned well across the portfolio in order to not essentially get ruined and be able to take advantage of the information, whatever might be available, depends on obviously how much volatility there is in the world that you're deciding about, but take whatever information that you're thinking about, you know? And so again, like just going back to the dating versus marrying, if you try to analyze the crap out of that and you only go on one date a year, that bad date's going to have a huge devastating effect on you. But if you just go on a lot of dates, one bad date is going to matter very little. It's essentially just saying, look, your decisions are like a stock portfolio, right? It's like an investment portfolio. And the more iterations that you can get, the more that you can think about the ways that you can do those in parallel, the more that you can think in certain cases about, you know, avoiding autocorrelation, you know, and just, again, there's a certain amount of kind of exploiting the things that are working for you that you should be doing, but you need to have this whole portfolio of just a bunch of crap. Try a bunch of stuff.
And this becomes, I think, difficult to analyze statistically, other than the idea of trying many things and experiment, and this concept of experimenting. These are a little bit more ambiguous to define, but mm-hmm. the methodology works. Like, yes. At least if someone's persistent with this methodology of making decisions by, you know, trying many different things and trying to analyze the different outcomes and then the probability of each outcome. And like you say, building a portfolio of this methodology works, but you can't statistically model everybody who uses this methodology statistically does better.
At least not yet. I mean, I completely agree with you. I don't know. I'd have to think about it more deeply in theory, whether you could.
Well, it depends on the domain too. Like if I'm trying to decide between, should I be a race car driver, a movie screenwriter, a professional investor, or, you know, a marketing director at Procter & Gamble, you're never going to be able to model. You could say this methodology works in general for people, but you could never say statistically you'll make better decisions in life. And I've analyzed this out with a computer and so on.
Yes. We know that people who do those kinds of things where they're actually trying that stuff out, where they're willing to try more things, they do better, but
They do better like in some domains. And so you can extrapolate that to domaining in general, to learning in general. Like what?
Right, but it's a skill. But the thing, I think that what you're trying to get at is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a meta skill, which is, yes. You know, what are the things that you should be experimental about and what aren't you? But I think that there are some heuristics that you can apply to that. So one thing is that you can say, if it goes as bad as possible, how much of an effect does that have on me, right? And if the effect is really big, you might not want to get so experimental, right? If it's like a really bad, devastating effect that's kind of hard to undo, you wouldn't want to get very experimental. Like I don't want to experiment on like a black diamond run, right? I want to sort of work my way up and figure out what are the things that I can do in between getting to the black diamond run that don't kill me. That's one thing to think about. Another thing to think about is, that I've been thinking about recently, is the difference between sort of what's the worst mistake, a false positive or a false negative. If the worst mistake is a false negative, you should be getting really experimental and just try a whole bunch of stuff, because the need to be able to, first of all, build better models of the world, to recognize that you're deciding with imperfect information. And so if a false negative is the worst mistake, the devastating effect of missing something would be to say no. Right, as opposed to say yes, you know. And then the other thing is, you know, is that given that we there is this whole universe of stuff we don't know, leaning toward yes on these kinds of things is more likely to get you to find out the things that you don't know, which is the really, really important stuff, right? Where you just, it's like something you hadn't even considered and you get to find out. But it matters what type of decision you're facing. And that's a lot, you know, part of what I talk about and how to decide is know what kind of decision that you're actually in front of and try to think about what the impact of getting it wrong is going to be. Because, you know, what is your ability to neutralize the decision? What's your ability to reverse it? What's your ability to do a whole bunch of stuff in parallel? That's just the portfolio issue, right? What's your ability to hedge against it? I mean, these are all really important questions as you try to figure out is this something that I do want to do a whole bunch of exploration around, or is this something that I want to do a whole bunch of analysis around?
You're right. So what I'm kind of trying to get at with this, with these, this idea of meta skills, and there's also correspondingly micro skills, but what I'm trying to get at is the difference between academic research on performance and self-betterment as opposed to experiential knowledge of it. So which, what I really like about your books, The Thinking in Probabilities, and then this one, How to Decide, is that you have achieved and accomplished, so you've been through the life experience of having to get better in a difficult domain where there's competition. Competition's critical because you have people also who are trying to basically destroy you and annihilate you that you're up against in their training as well. As opposed to just experience or just academic analysis, kind of trying to understand academically what happened to you in real life, I think is very interesting. And I kind of find with myself, whenever I try to get better at a different domain, I have to use the meta skills learned from prior domains or learned from reading and studying books like yours. And that helps me make these meta decisions better. Like, okay, this is how I'm going to learn. I'm going to take this new domain. I'm going to experiment a little bit. And by the way, to your point about kind of the cost of experimenting, this is well known for 200 years with the scientific method, is that an experiment should have low downside, infinite upside almost, or very, you know, huge upside. And basically that just, you're going to learn something from every experiment, and that it's going to have low downside in a worst case and huge upside.
And here's the another key is that it should mostly fail because yeah. What you want is that when it succeeds, you want it to be high signal.
Right. Hence the high upside. Like if every experiment results in high, that you do or results in high upside, you won't have time actually to do anything because you're just going to be succeeding all the time.
Right, exactly. So yeah, I mean, I think that this comes through in both of the books. You know, just because of my weird path, I think about the way that the scientific literature has a conversation with my, you know, poker and this kind of real world, very high stakes, very competitive. People are trying to annihilate you, as you said. Fast decision making, really understanding things like how much does it matter whether you're winning or losing in terms of your decision making? How do you figure out when you're supposed to quit? That's a really hard one, actually, in poker. Quit a game, I mean. Well, or I guess quit poker in general, quit a game or quit a hand. When are you supposed to fold?
Quit a hand is hard.
Right, when are you supposed to fold? How do you actually look back and try to figure out what is there to learn from a hand of poker when whether you won or lost a hand is actually quite low signal? You know, it's like after 1,500 hours, you know quite a bit. But, you know, after 1 hour, it's actually quite hard to parse that out. And how do you actually get down into the decision process and start to explore those decision trees and particularly the counterfactuals? What would have happened if I had done X? What would have happened if I had done Y? What would have happened if James had had a different hand? Whatever it is. And then think about that problem and the way that that actually creates a really interesting conversation between poker and the scientific literature, the cognitive science literature, the behavioral economics literature, the organizational psychology literature, to kind of see like how are they informing each other. And I live in the space between those two things because I'm an academic and I do academic research. And, you know, obviously I was a poker player and I think they're just really fertile ground because I agree with you. It's like just looking at poker isn't going to teach you to be a great decision maker. There are peculiarities of poker, for example, the fact that you have to do everything really fast, right? So what happens when you slow things down, right? Like, but you can take lessons from that. It can inform those kinds of decisions. When I think about the literature around like prospect theory, for example, and you know, loss aversion, you can see it so clearly playing out at the poker table that it becomes quite informative for understanding that literature and helping you to sort of refine the way that you might be thinking about it, for example. So that's just where I love to live, is in between the two things, the more theoretical world, the more academic world, the more experimental world. Scientific experiments meaning, and then this very practical real world decision-making problem.
Yeah. Because I mean, I don't know how much the academic research informed your book, How to Decide, but you know, this book that we're talking about, How to Decide, I find it to be an extremely you explain an extremely useful meta skill that can be applied to any domain for making decisions. And even if people don't accurately follow it, it's good enough to keep improving at something you want to make better and better decisions at, whether it's dating or poker or investing or entrepreneurship, chess, comedy, whatever. You know, the only thing I ever get worried about is sometimes the academic research is always clean and looks great. And again, like here, you know, Anders Ericsson's example with the 10,000 hour rule is a great example where I think people could get trapped into a form of analysis paralysis, trying to decide, do I want to get better at this? It's going to cost me 10,000 hours. It's too much reliance on the academic research instead of reliance on my own ability to learn meta skills quickly, which might be, you know, and I say me in the general me, but you know, each person's own ability to learn meta skills quickly or micro skills quickly, and to learn about experimenting and how to structure experiments in a new domain. And that completely does away with the 10,000 hour rule to some extent. So the 10,000 hour rule is a useful model, but it's not, you shouldn't live your life by any of the academic theories. You should get better at the practical stuff, learning from the academic theories.
So I kind of want to make a separation though. And I think this is true of grit as well, is that a lot of times the kind of popular translations of the academic work are misleading, anodyne, unnuanced. You know, when you look at sort of, the science of grit, for example, like nobody's saying that just because you're gritty at something, you're going to succeed, right? Just as an example. Obviously, it depends on the activity. There's some things that you can get much better at much more quickly. There's some things that you could put 10,000 hours in and like literally never succeed at it. There's in the same way that like some people are tall and some people are short, and I'm a woman who's 5'5". It doesn't matter how many hours I put into becoming an NBA superstar. Like it doesn't matter. I can't do it. I could put in 10,000 hours into trying to become a great pianist, and I can tell you it's not going to happen. Right? I'm just bad. So
look at that fixed mindset there. I don't know.
No, trust me. I took a year of piano lessons. I know a little bit about my piano skills. No, I mean, I'm tone deaf. It's just like, it's ridiculous. I just don't, musical talent is, I enjoy listening to music, but producing music is not in my wheelhouse. And part of this is like, everybody says like, you have to figure out, where am I going to spend the time? What is the payoff at the end of it for me? Is it within, and then the other thing is like, what's your goal, right? I put 10,000 hours into tennis. I'm not expecting to go to Wimbledon. I'm expecting to keep improving and become better and be able to be competitive. And I don't want to play like what you call country club tennis, which is like pitsy patsy. Like I really want to hit the ball, right? So like I have a different idea of what my goal is there. But I think that a lot of times, and I see this all the time, when you see scientific literature, which is like super nuanced, which is actually thinking about all these different ways that you can think about something, translated into sort of what the popular interpretation of it is, I think that you lose that nuance, because people like black and white answers. They like things to be yes and no. And then what happens is that can cause us to go back and say, well, that science is bad. But it's like the science isn't bad. It's the interpretation of the science that's bad. So like one of the examples that I saw of this, first of all, there's a great Twitter account that everybody should follow, which is just called In Mice. That's it.
InMice.
Yeah, it's just In Mice. And essentially what it does is, you know, you'll see these things which are like, bacon will cause cancer. And when you actually read it, it's like, it's not even studied in a human. And so there's a Twitter account that just says In Mice. Every time that happens, it just tweets the article out and says In Mice.
This is really great. Again, this only has like 51 followers. So nobody actually knows about this.
It's a great Twitter account. It just is In Mice. That's it. That's all it ever says. It's In Mice. Because it's letting you know that. I saw an article once, I can't remember. It was like on, CNBC or something like that, which was eating fish makes your kids smarter. So then I went and I looked at the actual source research. And it was like, there was essentially a correlation between eating fish, sleeping, and IQ, I think. It was something like that, IQ or grades or something that had to do with performance. And I was like, oh my God, I could have written 17 different headlines for that. Intelligent parents feed their children fish and make sure they sleep a lot. Sleeping makes you hungry for fish. Eating fish makes you sleep more, right? Smart kids like fish. Smart kids sleep a lot. I mean, it's, you know, so you'll see this thing where the translation of it is into something so incredibly simple. And, you know, this is part of the problem that I have with political conversation is that the nuance is just lost and everything has to be a simple message. And I think part of that just has to do with, you know, we know this work in processing fluency, that the easier it is for somebody to understand a message, the more true they think it feels, the more attachment they get to the message, the easier it is for them to recall, the more it's going to stick. So you can't sit there and go, well, there's this really interesting study that showed all these really cool correlations between all these things, but we have no idea of what the causality is. Here are some possibilities. Like, no, who's going to read that?
Yeah, no. And on top of it, a lot of papers, even no matter how good the academic, a lot of papers are just statistically wrong. So, you know, like, you know, there's a famous study on, is college better for your income versus not going to college?
Right.
And they determine after 30 years, you'll have an extra $500,000 net worth if you went to college versus if you didn't go to college, some outrageous statistic like that. But that's meaningless to people trying to decide whether to go to college now. That, because 30 years, right, that means they did that study on people who graduated in 1990, which
has nothing to do. By the way, they also found with that, again, not being, you know, the nuance, all of that difference was driven by the top tier universities.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That was where all the difference was, did you go to Harvard, basically.
Again, but this was, like, my kids quote me these studies because their high school counselors quote them these studies because some convention quoted those studies to the high school counselors. And so that's just all I get nervous about is when, you know, because I've talked to, you know, I've had 1,000 podcasts and I've talked to academics, I've talked to practitioners, I'm both to some extent. And so it's just something I'm always careful of.
So I think this comes back to, it's not just like the, again, I think it has to do with like, what's the understanding of what science is, right? So if you do a study like that, where you show that there's a correlation between income 30 years later and where you went to college, that's a study, you know, the way that science proceeds is that then creates more questions that then other people are going to answer. I'm putting this out into this whole thing with, you know, Mertonian scientific method. I put it out there and then people can start to pick that apart and kind of think about what would that mean. I think that most science is not trying to be prescriptive, right? Somebody does that study and the scientists aren't saying, so therefore you should go to college. It's like, oh, here's kind of an interesting correlation. Do what you want with it. But then the journalists pick it up. And they're like, study says you should go to college if you want to earn more money. And it's like, that's not at all. The researchers did not say that in any way. You know, and you go back and you read the research and they're like, oh, they didn't say that in any way. You know, and they actually talk about the nuances. And, you know, it's part of what peer review is that peer reviewers will say, okay, but, you know, what happens in the short run? Or did you, you know, what happens to X or Y or whatever? And, you know, I think it's why I appreciate a lot of the more, like a book like Range from David Epstein, where it is a much deeper dive that's much truer to the science, right? I really appreciate these books that are really trying to translate that science in a way that it's sort of exploring, like, what could this mean?
Right. But I will say also about Range, one of the things I appreciate about it also is that David Epstein, the author, is a practitioner. So he's not just talking about, oh, you can, if you're good at one thing and you put 3,000 hours in and you're good at another thing, you put 1,000 hours in and you combine them, it's like 10,000 hours. He was a geologist / scientist, but also a sports writer, and combining the two to be able to write about the science of sports, that allowed him essentially to skip the line and become the youngest columnist for Sports Illustrated. And so I appreciate that as a practitioner, how he's able to kind of understand the science from a point of view of, oh yeah, this is what happened to me, and it's reflected properly in the science.
Right. Well, and I think that's so important. And, you know, I mean, to that point, I think that's some of the issues that I have with Malcolm Gladwell, is that he's translating incredibly complicated topics into super, super simple messages. And, you know, and it takes a moment of reflection to realize that 10,000 hours doesn't cause success. right? That there, as you said, as you were thinking about investing, like where we kind of started the conversation around poker and investing, as you start to sort of dive into it, you feel like, oh, wait, but how big is the stage, right? And how many people are in the audience? And, you know, how much have they had to drink? And how much, like all this other stuff, like are there Republicans or Democrats in the audience? Like all of this stuff that you start to realize, wait, no, there's this whole world of nuance. It's like it depends on the activity. It depends on the person going into the activity. It depends on, you know, what the learning loops are that you can create, it, you know, so on and so forth. Like it doesn't take me 10,000 hours to become a tic-tac-toe expert. It's literally 1 second of thinking about tic-tac-toe. You realize, oh, there has to be nuance.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating in every domain. Again, I always say every domain that's worth learning, because this is where, and you could define it as, you know, 20 levels of skill, or there's 50 micro skills or whatever, however you define this. This is an activity that's interesting and complicated, but like, it's just fascinating the, as you discover more and more variables in something like comedy, say, for instance. So you have to see how many men are there with girlfriends, because a man won't laugh. And this is a variable no one's going to know unless they've done comedy like 1,000 times. Men will very quickly look at their girlfriend before they laugh. Because,
oh, yeah, that makes sense. It totally makes sense once you say it. I love things like that are like so obvious once you say it, but I would never think about that.
Yeah, it's like sometimes it's just a microsecond, and sometimes it just happens once, because then they get the cue that, oh, okay, she's cool about this and that. But you could also tell, you know, how long they've been dating, so how long it matters whether she laughs or not. But because there's even sub nuances within that.
Yeah, but like on the first date, they're going to be like, okay, wait, let me see. Like
and I've seen it happen. The date is over if he laughs and she doesn't. Like that's the end of the date. So, and you know, and part of it you could tell by, and again, all these are nuances. You could tell by how many inches they are sitting apart from each other. And a rule of thumb that I've just developed for myself is that for every inch they are sitting apart, that's how many years they've been together. So if they're sitting very close, or if their legs are touching or their hands are touching, obviously they're first dating. If they're sitting on the opposite sides of the table, you could make fun of one completely and the other would laugh because they like their spouse being made fun of and, you know, whatever. So it just gives you different ranges. It's just like on poker. When you're asking yourself, if someone makes a bet against you, that's a threatening bet, you think to yourself, what are the range of possibilities they have? And it's the same thing in the audience. What are the range of jokes you could tell for this audience based on all of these different nuances and based on what you've seen?
Yes, I imagine before. It's quite different if you're in front of like evangelical Christians. Your range might get narrower in terms of the jokes that you can tell versus, you know.
I always ask myself, and I don't have any jokes for this really, but I always ask myself, can this audience, and this is going to sound extreme, but can this audience be told a joke about abortion? And because that will tell you the range of jokes. If they absolutely can't, that puts you in a different category than if they can. Not that I have an abortion joke waiting to go, like that I'm dying to tell.
No, but it's a good way to think about, like, particularly as you sort of delve in. I mean, a lot of jokes are obviously poking around at things that get into the moral realm. So I think that's what that's kind of getting for to you, right? Like, how much am I allowed to kind of be like poking around and breaking norms?
Yeah,
I assume that's true. Kind of what that's answering for you.
Yeah, and also the you know, this year in particular, the Trump-Biden thing has become very complicated because, you know, typical audience doesn't believe this, but they're going to be about 50-50 Trump-Biden, like the entire country is. But most people think everybody's for Biden or everybody's for Trump. So there's a huge bias. You ever notice that people who like Trump, they assume Trump's going to win the election because the polls are all wrong, and everybody loves Biden thinks Biden's going to have, there's going to be a blue wave in the Senate. And you refer to this a lot in How to Decide, that decisions are influenced a lot by biases. And one question I have for you is, okay, there's a lot of different biases, like in particular hindsight bias, like, and this is, or outcome bias, where, oh, I made a decision and it worked out really well, so I must be a genius. And so that's kind of this outcome bias. And, you know, Daniel Kahneman, who came up with all these cognitive biases, he would say that you can't really learn to overcome your biases, but I sort of disagree with that. I sort of feel, and I'm curious what you think, if you're, and I think I know where you are based on what you say in this book, but if you're aware of the biases, that if you're just aware of the definition of the biases, you're much more likely to kind of catch yourself with them.
So if you're aware of the definition of the biases, you're much more likely to end up with a biased decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
so like, for instance, I won't let myself decide who's going to win the election because I might be biased.
But that's different. So let me explain. So there's a difference between figuring out how to set up guardrails around the biases, which you need to understand what the biases are in order to be able to do, versus on the fly, you make a decision. And then you kind of look back at it, right? So when you, there's something called bias blind spot, which is just what are your blind spots to your own biases? Like as you come to conclusions, how good are you at spotting when confirmation bias might be at play, for example. And it just turns out that people who know about more about bias have bigger blind spots to that kind of stuff. I think partly because they're aware of it, they get the sense that then they don't do it, right? Like it's kind of intuitive that way. That's okay, right? That's fine.
So they're aware of it, so they think that that they're better equipped to not do it.
Exactly.
Which is what I was kind of just trying to say.
Right. But here's the thing. But that's okay because what Kahneman will tell you is that whether it comes to bias or noise in your decision making, which is inconsistencies, and you know, you'll make a decision on Monday and the same information on Tuesday afternoon, you'll come to a different conclusion, which is not great. That there you can set up guardrails around it. And that's essentially what this book is offering. Like when I'm talking about decision tools, I'm saying these things are gonna get you to a more consistent process that's gonna give you a more accurate output. So as an example, if we think about hindsight bias, right? Like actually taking the time to say, well, let me actually list out what are the things that were known and that I knew at the time. And then I have to like check on those things to make sure that those things are true. So I actually go through the example and I'll tell you a very funny story about it. So, you know, I talk about this, the sort of the way that people have processed what happened with Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Oh yeah, that was a good chapter.
Yeah, and you know, this is sort of a resulting end of hindsight bias story. So she loses Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, quite unexpected. And everybody says it's a mistake, right? I mean, to this day, like everybody's just like, that was a mistake. That was stupid. And first of all, that's just resulting, right? Like she got a bad result. That doesn't mean that the decision process about where she was going to spend campaign money and her time was a mistake. The way that you would figure out actually whether it was a mistake is to go back and look and see if people were really pointing this out at the time. Because you, this is this knowledge tracking, right? What was known beforehand? What were the inputs in that to that decision? Because unless I understand that, I can't actually figure out what that decision tree looked like in terms of that resource allocation to try to figure out whether that it was a reasonable decision or not. So you go back and you can look, you can just Google it. And you can say, did people notice that there was a polling error? Because the one fact that we know is that you can't put there was a polling error in the beforehand knowledge. That has to be in the after the fact knowledge because you can't know there's a polling error until the vote's been taken.
By the way, there might not have been a polling error because there's some things were beyond margin of error, but margin of error is just
yeah, there was a lot of stuff that was in the margin of error. It does turn out that there was a polling error, which we know in retrospect, which is white, non-college voters were being undersampled in those three states. I would like to point out, though, that even if you thought maybe there was a polling error, you can't predict the direction because Texas had an equally large polling error, but it went in Clinton's favor, right? So, I mean, but we don't remember that, right? Because she lost the election, so we're not looking at that, right? Virginia actually had quite a large polling error in Clinton's favor. So, you know, polling errors happen, but you don't really know them at the time. And it's, you can make some predictions about them, but it's hard because it's not clear would it go, whose favor would it go in. And it's true right now, like there may be a polling error in Pennsylvania, but it may be in Biden's favor. We don't know. He's from Scranton, whatever. So that's number one. Then number two, you can say, well, but maybe data analysts are smart enough or political observers are smart enough to look at that and say, even though the vote hasn't been taken, I think there's a really big problem with the polling. And actually, they should be totally changing their campaign strategy and get the hell out of Arizona and North Carolina and get their butts into the Rust Belt, right? But there's crickets. Like you just can't find any articles of people arguing this. In fact, there's people arguing the opposite, which is why is Trump even bothering with Pennsylvania? He should be spending his time in Florida. So now you can see, so there's resulting, which is I'm saying this is a mistake because I know that she lost. And then you add into it this hindsight bias problem, which is that people believe they knew it at the time. And what's really interesting about it is that despite the fact that I can produce the Google results, I can produce the complete lack of evidentiary record that anybody knew this, I had three different editors at major newspapers reject it because they claimed that they knew it at the time. And I said, you're an editor at a major newspaper. If you knew it at the time, why didn't you print it? Because that would have been a clickable article. It would have gone viral. Everybody would have read your nice contrarian take. So you literally had the ability to say what you say that you knew, and you still didn't say it. And then one person produced an article, which was a voter in Wisconsin complaining that Hillary Clinton hadn't been there, which of course is not even germane to the issue right. of whether people spotted a polling error. But it's so strong that even people who worked at places where they could have printed these things in the pages of the places they worked still were completely convinced that they knew about it at the time. So how do you solve for that? I need them to go do the search themselves. I need them to actually write down, what did we know at the time? What did we know after the time? Is it reasonable? Like, I can sit down with that person. Is it reasonable that the one article you found was a voter complaining that Hillary Clinton hadn't come said hi, right? Which I'm sure everybody in California is complaining about as well.
So, right? but you make a great point right now. They need to do the research themselves. So like, no matter how much I would have known about outcome, you know, resulting or hindsight bias or whatever. So the very first time I sold a company in the 90s, made millions of dollars, thought I was a super genius because of the result, even though there was a huge luck factor, you know, there was an internet boom at the time. Because I was thinking I was a genius, I proceeded to lose all my money in a bunch of investments, like within a year afterwards. But now that I've been through that, every time I sell a business again, I'm so paranoid that I'm going to lose money. I'm much more careful about not thinking I'm a genius about it. So again, is that a way to overcome these biases, is just by experiencing these things? Or am I now biased towards thinking I'm stupid? Or maybe now I'm biased thinking I'm smart because I think I'm stupid all the time.
Yeah, so I think that's why I offer these tools. The key is to get to an objective place and to realize that the best way to get to an objective place is to get to the outside view. So the inside view is what you're talking about. It's like my own experiences are informing what I think and what I do. I have certain mental models that I sort of apply to everything, right? I mean, this is kind of how our minds work, right? When I look at particular data, like you can see this with something like gun control data, right? Like somebody who believes in gun control will look at the data and say, now I believe in it more. And somebody who doesn't believe in gun control will look at the exact same data and say, now I believe in it more. And that's because they're being informed by their own frameworks and what they believe to be true of the world. So you have to develop a decision process that causes you to get outside of that point of view. And that's naturally going to get you to apply more than one mental model to the problem that you're looking at, because you're going to have to interact with other ones. It's going to cause you to explore that sort of universe of stuff that you don't know in a completely different way, and in a more objective way. And it's going to cause you to naturally be open-minded to what other people's points of view are. So, you know, and there's three ways to do it. Let me try to figure out what's true of the world. Let me go find some base rates. It's really good. So base rates would be, for example, if you make an investment in a particular type of company, you know, you obviously think that you have some special knowledge about that company and that obviously your taste is amazing because you just won all this money in the lottery of the internet in the 1990s, right? But if you went and looked and you said, for this particular type of company, let's say it's a startup, for this particular type of company in this particular space, what's the failure rate within 3 years, right? So you can look at that and you can see, oh my gosh, you know, 90% of companies in this space don't even exist after 3 years. That just disciplines your own optimism, right? It says, okay, this is what's actually true of the world. This is the rate at which this thing happens in general. And then I can sort of think about how can I toggle off that number? It gives you the appropriate anchor to toggle off of.
I see what you're saying. So instead of saying, okay, well, 80% of these businesses fail, so I better not try it, it just gives you a base to say, well, what is my unique advantage versus the people who fall into the 80 or the 20% side of this equation?
That's number one. And number two, it tells you that you should make a lot of small investments instead of one big one.
Right.
Right. So it's fine, right? Like you hopefully you're a better picker than the market and you can figure out how much of a better picker. And the thing is that if there's a 20% failure rate and you can pick things that fail at an 18% rate, you're going to make a lot of money. That's way better than the market, right? So you don't need to talk, you want to be at the appropriate anchor, but then that also tells you I shouldn't make three big investments, right? I need to make many, many, many smaller investments.
Right, right. But now I'm thinking in terms of like whether you should invest it. So one type of investment is, of course, being an entrepreneur, investing in yourself, which is an investment of time and money. And it's significant because it crowds out other activities. And this is related to all these biases, but I call it specifically smoking crack bias. Like everybody I know who starts a business typically smokes crack about their idea. Like they think their business is the best thing ever. It's the next Google. The sky's the limit. And you can't tell them otherwise because of they're biased. And so I wonder if this is considered a guardrail. So for me, I literally ask all the time, am I smoking crack? Am I smoking crack?
Yeah.
Like if there's 7 billion people on this planet, why am I the one blessed with this amazing idea? And I'll go so far as to look at, like if it's a software company I'm starting, I will read the resumes of all the developers of all the competitors just to try to understand why they have not developed this one thing that I'm developing.
So that's actually one of the types of guardrails that I include in the book, which is this kind of checklisting, right? What are the things that I need to be thinking about? What are the things that I need to input? What are the things that I need to worry about? What are the ways that this could go wrong? If I imagine that I failed in a year, why? Mm. Right. And creating those checklists of like, I know when I'm in it, that things are going to get distorted. So when I'm not in it, let me try to think about what is the information that I need to go gather? Whose perspectives would it be really good for me to go talk to? Let me actually try to make sure that I'm doing a premortem and trying to figure out if this failed, why would that be? Let me do a backcast. If it succeeded, why would that be? And this all just makes it so that you're doing less of the decision-making when you have skin in the game already and more in advance of actually having started down a path when you're in a more logical mind, right? Because we can all see that other people are smoking crack, but it's hard for us to see that in ourselves. So if you include that in your process, you're going to be a lot better off. And the thing I want to be clear about is that I get this question all the time, but then wouldn't you never start a company? And the answer is, of course you would, because when you look at the upside potential of it actually succeeding, for a lot of people, that payoff is worthwhile, even though the failure rate is really high. But what this is going to do is that if you can toggle that success rate based on developing a better product, creating a stronger moat, making sure that the product market fit is better, making sure that people actually like the thing that you're developing early on so that maybe you can pivot and change it so that people will like it better, all of those things, then that's actually going to create the success. But that requires that you go into it understanding, I understand I'm mostly going to fail. And now I'm just going to be completely single-minded and trying to find all the ways that I'm going to fail and make sure that I'm not doing those things, that I'm creating the best product, that I'm using a process that's actually going to get me to success the most.
Right. It's like what I always tell starting entrepreneurs is that the job of an entrepreneur is not to take risks, but to actually mitigate risks. So lots of people come up with good ideas, but then success is often determined, like you said, by coming up. What you're saying with your checklist is my way of saying, okay, every day, reduce risk. Like come up with more and more ways to reduce risk because I might not know the whole checklist in advance.
Right, and then also, right, exactly. And then also kind of back to the beginning to really understand that you don't know more about the thing that you're creating than the people who are going to use the thing you're creating. And I think that this is a really big problem, right? Is that you go in and you're smoking crack about whatever it is that you're developing in your product. And it's generally not until too late that you find out that there's a reason why nobody developed it. Sometimes you found a hole that people haven't seen. But sometimes there's a big there's a reason why no one developed it. So how can you actually find that out quickly enough? Well, that requires that you step back and say, what is the information that I could find out today that would help me to understand whether this is actually something reasonable or not? And it's not going to be by doing thought experiments.
Right. It's never by, that's the thing. It's never by thought experiments. It's right. always doing something. And a lot of this is so you do something to develop that outside view that you talk about. So you get out of your inside view where you think, oh my gosh, this is a great idea. And you start to build an outside perspective, an outside view.
Yeah. I mean, how many times have you heard entrepreneurs say things like, well, they just don't get it, but this is a really good thing. Like they just don't understand what it is that I'm making.
Every half hour.
Right. And it's like, okay, well, either explain it better or there's a reason they don't get it. And it's because you're the one who's wrong. Right. I mean, the thing is that like the minute that you put an iPhone in your hand, everybody gets it. It's like, oh yes, this is solving a pain point for me.
No, and look, what I because I know you're sensitive to time here, I just want to say that all of this is the type of thinking and reasoning and rational reasoning that goes into this book. This is such a great book for building mental models on decisions. Like I like how you define the two forms of uncertainty, which we've spoken about both in this conversation: imperfect information and luck. So in poker, imperfect information is you don't know what's in the hand of the other person. And luck is you might get lucky on the card. Yeah, the dealer is the luck and the other player has information. I like these three Ps, preferences, payoffs, and probabilities. So do what you want, but then also analyze what's the possible payoff, what's the possible downside, and what are the probabilities of all the different outcomes that could happen in doing what you want to do. And you have tons of these models that are very easy to understand. It's based on, again, both your experiences and the research, and you have references and sources for all the research. And I just thought this was really great. It got me so excited because I think all the time, and particularly this is important in this day and age, there are so many more decisions being made right now mm-hmm. than in other years, because 55 million Americans applied for unemployment insurance in the past 6 months. They're all deciding what they want to do for the rest of their lives. And how to decide, and then how to learn if they decide to do something new. These are going to be critical things that weren't as critical before.
Right.
And so a book like this, I think, is really valuable. And I think this is also a great sequel to your prior book, Thinking in Probabilities, which we talked about a few years ago. You know, and again, I think understanding how to build these guardrails around cognitive biases, like you use the example, 90% of all drivers think they're above the 50% level in driving, which is, of course, mathematically impossible. I always like to remind myself, I know I'm the 1 in 10 that's the worst, but
right.
It doesn't really comfort me for other biases, but at least I know that. So I do want to say this is a great book. I really recommend it. I'm so glad you came on the podcast, and I know the conversation went all over, but hey,
I just say, though, that it was fun for me because, you know, I end up talking to a lot of people where it's straight down the middle following the order of the book. And this was like much more exploratory about like the type of thinking that's actually informing the book. Like how am I trying to get people to think about problems, right? Because this isn't like, how do you decide what job to take? Where I'm giving you like the 5-point plan for getting a great job, which, you know, I mean, obviously that kind of thing maybe has its place, not for me, but this is more how do you think about your thinking? How do you think about your decisions?
Right.
How do you develop a really good toolkit that you can sort of pull out and apply? What are the different mental models that you can be approaching decisions through? How do you think about the way that you interact with information? And when you think about the difference between luck and hidden information, which are those two sources of uncertainty, luck is something that you can't actually do anything about. You know, despite people saying like, I make my own luck, that's just an absurd statement. I can't make the dealer deal a particular card. Like it just is. That's not to say that you don't have to see luck. You don't have to know how much luck is going to influence the outcome. You certainly do have to have a good eye on that. And that's a little bit what base rates are going to help you with, right?
And by the way, your book, Thinking in Probabilities, also helps to deal with luck over the long term.
Right, exactly. But it's the hidden information part. It's that we're deciding behind the veil of ignorance or a partial veil of ignorance that what we know fits on the head of a pin, and what we don't know is like the size of the universe. And if we don't get better at that thing, if we don't figure out how can we go explore that universe of stuff we don't know in a more objective way, so that the inputs in our decisions are just like higher quality, so that we can improve the quality of the beliefs that are informing our decisions, it doesn't really matter what you build on top of that. The foundation sucks. So this book is really about what is your approach to information? How are you thinking about what other people think? How are you thinking about information that comes across your path? How are you applying that to the decisions that you make so that you can make higher quality decisions?
And I think also, you mentioned it briefly, but then it also runs throughout the book, the themes of it, analysis paralysis, where you spend too many minutes deciding what TV show to watch or where to go to eat and stuff like that. I think things like the checklists that you recommend are good for those, and also just being aware of how you spend your time so you can reduce the analysis paralysis. There's a lot of good suggestions for things that people don't even realize are problems in their daily lives.
Well, thank you.
Annie Duke, How to Decide, Simple Tools for Making Better Choices. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.